Oh, so I guess I should just, while that's happening, introduce myself briefly to those that don't know me. I'm Fireweed. I've been here on Demmon since the early 90s, and I came from Cortez Island, where I've been living and working, studying permaculture up there on Linnea Farm. I was up there for a couple of years. I founded the Demmon Island Veganic Potluck Series, not veganic, the Vegan Potluck Series, back in the early 90s, and probably about 100 potlucks really over the years, always plant-based, and not necessarily to do with animal issues, social justice issues, anything to do with the environment, films, guest speakers. And our next one is actually coming up on December 21st for the winter solstice. We always have a gathering, so you're all invited. The idea is food lovers of every persuasion are invited to come together and enjoy this lovely plant-based feast. I'm also a co-founder of Spuds, our organic potato co-op, which is now in its 11th year, I believe. Mike and I actually just retired last year from our long-term involvement with that project to put energy into other areas. But a very successful local food sustainability initiative that has practiced regenerative methods. I also write for the Island Word. I have a monthly column that comes out. It's called The Transition Kitchen. I've been doing that for about 6 years. And it is all about climate-friendly food and related social justice food issues. I should mention that I host a Facebook group called The Elephant in the Room is a Cow. And it's really, it's not a discussion forum. It's really an archive, a repository of data, scientific studies, articles, anything to do with the impact of animal agribusiness on the environment. So it's very narrowly focused. But we have thousands of articles, well, hundreds of articles anyway, maybe thousands, over the last 6 years, compiled there. And a lot of my information tonight, can be sourced on that site. I think that's all I really need to say by way of an introduction regarding my interest in this particular topic. So it's been long-term. Can't even read my own handwriting here. Yeah, that'll do. So growing the 12-year diet, pretty daunting, this information from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And did anybody here watch the clip with Elizabeth May in the House? Very impassioned. I highly recommend clicking on that link on Facebook to watch her presentation. She really made a plea to her colleagues in the House to take this extremely seriously, stating, and I really resonated with her position, that she's been on the sidelines, actively trying to raise awareness for 30 years. And, I'm at that stage in life, too, where I feel like, oh, my God, you know, all of these efforts that we put forward, you know, to what end? We just have to work so much harder now. We've really lost a lot of time. And, you know, through this series, we've really seen some of the progress made, and other countries have been mentioned. So Canada really needs to catch up. We have a lot going for us, but we could do much better. So let's see if I can get this working. Thank you very much for the water. And I totally forgot to say, if you could hold your questions till the end, that will allow us more time for discussion. All right, so when I first started prepping for this presentation, I added this image as an interim title page. Because the really good news about the importance of reducing our carbon footprints through our dietary choices is that those of us with the privilege of choice have so many attractive options available to us, especially when it comes to increasing our intake of healthy fruits and vegetables. But a few days ago, I realized that this is where I really need to begin. These are some of the Central American migrants taking part in the caravans heading to the United States right now. Desperate families that Trump is sending military troops to hold back at the U.S. border. According to an article in The Guardian, and I quote, "The main reason people are moving is because they don't have enough to eat." Some of the folks heading north may have once grown the coffee so many of us take for granted every day. Since 2012, however, coffee plants across Central America have been ravaged by leaf rust, a fungus that normally dies when temperatures drop down in the evening. But warming nights have allowed it to thrive, affecting some 70% of coffee farms in Honduras, for example, leading to wide-scale unemployment. This image features an El Salvadoran farmer who has lost his entire maize crop to the drought that has plagued Central America for at least the past 4 years now. The World Bank estimates that warming temperatures and extreme weather will force an estimated 3.9 million climate migrants to flee Central America alone over the next 30 years. Now, all of us here understand that drought and famine are not new, right? And the people who have been dying unnecessarily around the world from starvation for a very long time. An unacceptable reality, given that there has actually been plenty of food to go around, only lack of access for those in greatest need. But what the new IPCC report makes abundantly clear is that whatever privilege any one of us currently benefit from is not going to be enough to change to protect our own children or grandchildren from the decisions made by climate change deniers in positions of power. Those who refuse to connect the dots are indeed threatening the future of all life on Earth. The significance of the election last week of right-winger Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil for the presidency simply cannot be overlooked. The Amazon rainforest, commonly referred to as the lungs of our planet, covers 2.1 million square miles. It performs a critical check on human-caused climate change by removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, using the carbon to grow, and as we've learned, of course, releasing oxygen back into the air. This vast ecosystem is estimated to house one-sixth of all the carbon stored in vegetation around the world. But the World Wildlife Fund reports that a fifth of the Amazon has disappeared in just 50 years. And Bolsonaro is a climate change denier who only plans to roll back environmental protection and literally bulldoze indigenous people's rights into oblivion. In an extraordinary and disturbing threat filmed recently in Brazil's Congress, Bolsonaro told the tribes of Roraima State what he planned to do in Raposa Serra do Sol, a large indigenous territory recognized in 2005 after years of bitter conflict with cattle ranchers. "We are going to rip up Raposa Serra do Sol," he said, "and give guns to the ranchers." Following Bolsonaro's election, the program director of Amazon Watch stated that the new president's plans to industrialize the Amazon in concert with Brazilian and international agribusiness and mining sectors, and I have to say, we can very well expect those will be Canadian interests getting their hands in there, will bring untold destruction to the planet's largest rainforest and the communities who call it home, spelling disaster for the global climate. Data from the Brazilian government suggests that more than 60% of desertified land, deforested land, forgive me, is already dedicated to cattle. One quarter of the Earth's land, excluding Antarctica, is used as pasture land, and it has to be mentioned that beef accounts for one-third of the global water footprint of farm animal production. Ruminants, of which cattle are the most common, accounted for nearly half of all agricultural production-related greenhouse gas emissions in 2010. If cattle were able to form their own nation, they would rank third behind China and the United States among the world's largest greenhouse gas emitters. Now, soy production, too, is a major contributor to the deforestation of Brazil, which, if halted, could reduce that country's carbon emissions by another 30%. But it is an all-too-common misconception that this has to do with meeting the demand for soy-based food items enjoyed by people interested in avoiding animal products. In fact, soybean cultivation is expanding in the Amazon due primarily to economics associated with animal agribusiness. Including organically grown soy products in our daily fare is actually a great way to reduce our carbon footprint and meet our daily, our dietary protein needs. Research published in the journal Science this past summer states that plant-based diets can cut land use by 76% and halves the greenhouse gases and other pollutions that are caused by food production. Just this past July, A report published by the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy and the NGO Grain revealed that the world's five largest meat and dairy corporations, you can see them at the top there, are already responsible for more annual greenhouse gas emissions than ExxonMobil, Shell, or BP. So clearly, it's not only fossil fuel extraction that we must divest from. The impact of animal agriculture on climate change has been marginalized for far too long. The new IPCC report underscores the urgency with which we must, and I quote, improve farming practices and limit demand for greenhouse gas-intensive foods, shifting to healthier and more sustainable diets. According to the World Resources Institute, even when accounting for future improvements in agriculture and reductions in food waste, shifting the diets of higher-income consumers towards plant-based foods will remain essential for meeting climate targets. Without a major reduction in foods with outsized climate impacts, researchers predict that agriculture alone could eat up the majority of our limited emissions, the budget of the limited emissions. Okay. So compared to all sources, agriculture's 8% share of Canada's GGH emissions may seem small. And in fact, the information that my colleague over here provided said 10%. This is the report that I found says 8. But very large volumes of fuel and fertilizers, as Lisa mentioned, are used to run farms and both contribute to national GHG emissions. The actual manufacturing of fertilizers is counted under industrial processes and product use. And so the numbers here only represent the emissions that are released when fertilizer is applied to a field. So that could account for that additional, at least a portion of the higher number. A very important way to reduce emissions, as Lisa emphasized, is through reduced tillage. And this, of course, applies to field crops, whether raised for human consumption or as feed for livestock. In fact, minimizing soil disturbance by limiting tillages has been a guiding principle in our field management with SPUDs, our potato co-op here on Demmin, for over the last decade. Industrial-scale livestock operations in Canada also produce large volumes of GHGs. Methane produced by ruminants, both through the enteric fermentation and manure processes that Lisa mentioned, is far more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. It traps up to 100 times more heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide within a five-year period, for example. So it's really important for people to note that if they're looking to pasture-raise beef to help reduce their carbon footprints, grass-fed cows actually emit significantly more methane than their kin raised on grain and intensive feedlot operations. In fact, recent research has calculated that grass-fed beef generates 19% more emissions per kilogram because grass is less nutritionally dense and harder to digest. Free-ranging animals are also kept alive longer because they grow more slowly, burning the calories needed to move around. And, of course, they drink a lot more water. Interest in rotational grazing as a potential means of sequestering carbon is very high these days. So I know this is a very contentious topic. But a comprehensive two-year study released just last year by Oxford scientists found, and I quote, that well-managed grazing in some contexts, the climate, soils, and management regime all have to be just right, can cause some carbon to be sequestered in soils. But the maximum global potential, using generous assumptions, would offset only 20 to 60% of emissions from grazing cattle. The researchers concluded that even in a best-case scenario, grazing livestock are net contributors to the climate problem, as are all livestock. Good grazing management cannot offset its own emissions, let alone those arising from other systems of animal production. In the U.S., where, 41%, can you believe it? 41% of land is already used for livestock. Researchers have determined that a nationwide shift to pasture-raised cattle would require increasing the number of animals by 30%. Just to produce the same quantity of beef as the present-day system. So at this point I want to say, you know, I really have nothing against cows personally. I've worked and lived on farms with cows, and I appreciate them as lovely, gentle creatures. But their role in global market forces, their absolutely enormous environmental footprint on our planet as a whole, simply cannot be overstated as we prepare ourselves for the massive societal transformation necessary if we are to stay below a 1.5 Celsius rise in global temperatures. When it comes to the big picture, impacts of food production and farming, it's easier to find good data, graphs, and maps from international sources than Canadian ones, it seems to me. But of course, here too in BC, farmed animals are an invasive species. Just over a century ago, in 1914 in Kinkem Inlet, Hereditary Chief Cecil Hollis reported to the Royal Commission on Indian Affairs for the province of BC about the impact of imported livestock on his people, explaining how they had contributed to the elimination of food gathering for berries and greens and decimated traditional root digging grounds. His words were recorded as follows: "And then the animals of the white man, such as the pigs and cattle, would come and eat it off. And then my forefathers and the women got tired and gave it up when they saw their food was destroyed by the cattle." And of course, the deforestation initiated by settlers in our area of the world continues to this day. We are, in essence, a Brazil of the North. Over half of Vancouver Island's old growth is now gone. And even the BC government has admitted that our forests now emit rather than store carbon. If we are to reduce carbon emissions to pre-industrial levels, massive reforestation efforts are going to be required worldwide, alongside other initiatives. Habitat encroachment by dairy and beef farmers right here in BC into the traditional territories of predators like wolves, cougars, and bears pit our food habits against the interests of species who help maintain ecosystems. While ranchers tend to blame elk for destroying forage they believe their cattle are entitled to, increased grazing also prevents new tree sprouts from reestablishing forests, once again holding back the potential for greater carbon storage in healthy ecosystems. But wait, what about animal products that are further down the list? Well, here's the thing. While animal farming takes up 83% of the world's agricultural land, it delivers only 18% of the world's calories. Alan Shepin of the Wiseman Institute and colleagues have looked at this in terms of what is called opportunity costs. Choosing to make a gram of protein by feeding an egg-laying hen, rather than getting the equivalent of a gram of egg protein from plants, has an opportunity cost of 40%. The opportunity cost with poultry is 50%, 75% for dairy, 90% for pork. Getting the gram of protein from beef represents an opportunity cost of 96%. These researchers argue that if we stop paying these opportunity costs and people simply ate the protein from plants themselves, instead of converting it into animal products, this would be equivalent to increasing the food supply on our planet by a third, or eliminating all of the losses due to food waste. As you can see here, the actual bulk of food wasted every year is fruits, vegetables, roots, and tubers. I look at that and I want it for my compost. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, or FAO, the average waste per capita in Europe and North America is 209 to 254 pounds every single year. All of this food lost or wasted worldwide would feed around a billion people. The FAO estimates that this wasting of 30% of all food across the supply chain contributes 8% of all global emissions. And we mustn't forget all the metal cans, plastic bags, and cardboard packaging. By throwing away half a store-bought lasagna, for example, half the emissions that resulted from producing and processing, packaging, shipping, storing, picking up, and cooking were also wasted. And if there were animal products in that lasagna, well, I think we can all do the math, right? So it's really heartening to see how much land we would save if more of us switched over to a plant-based diet. But, you know, where are we supposed to get all this protein if we're not relying on animal products, right? And how on earth are we going to grow the food without animal manure? So I'm going to come back to that second question eventually. But first of all, for those of us with access to a wide variety of plant foods, there is no need to be concerned about not getting enough protein. It is readily available in everything from leafy greens to nuts and seeds, grains, pulses, and legumes of all kinds. Canada's new food guide, which will be out early in the new year, actually, I think you can see it online. It's about to be, you know, officialized in the new year. But it's very helpful, actually. It encourages a plant-rich diet. There's no longer a centering of dairy products and meat products as integral to optimum health. So it has purportedly heeded the advice of the World Health Organization and taken our card food print into consideration also. A joint statement from the president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment and the executive director of the Canadian Public Health Association states that Health Canada's guiding principles represent an important step towards a food policy that protects the health of people directly and through care of the planet that sustains us. So just for fun, I kept food intake notes at home for a couple of days last week. Try to pay attention to portion sizes. Not a bad idea to do on a more regular basis. And I determined that Mike and I were really getting more than enough of the recommended dietary intake of protein and other essential nutrients. On days when meal planning is more of a hit and miss, I'll toss extra nuts and seeds in a salad or stir fry, or you know, maybe an extra couple of tablespoons of hemp seeds into our green smoothies. It's really not difficult to punch up the extra grams. It just takes paying attention and knowing a bit more about the nutritional content of the foods we eat. So I'm not going to be addressing nutrition in a broader context here, because in relation to reducing our carbon footprints, my point is really simply to illustrate that the majority of us here looking to move away from dependency upon animal foods in our diets really needn't worry about finding adequate replacements. Of course, folks with dietary restrictions for health reasons are best advised to seek advice from a qualified nutritionist. Accurate measurements of any particular carbon footprint can be tricky without a full life cycle analysis, also called an LCA. But a significant amount of research emphasizes that cutting out all animal products would reduce our emissions more than simply eating all locally produced foods. Wonderful if one is in a position to grow all their own food, dry it, can it, store it in other ways. But since most of us still rely on others to grow a significant portion of our food, buying in season is always going to make the most sense. And when regionally produced fruits and vegetables are side by side with imports at the grocery store, it's important to check their origins. Did you notice that asparagus was listed in the top 10 highest carbon emitters? Well, Martin Heller, a research specialist at the University of Michigan Center for Sustainable Systems, says it comes down to transportation. Produce that requires air freight tends to have an exceptionally high GHG. This would include a number of tender fruits and vegetables. But you may be surprised to learn that bananas actually have a low carbon footprint compared with the nourishment that they provide. Anyway, there are three main reasons that bananas have such small carbon footprints compared with the nourishment they provide. They are grown in natural sunlight, for one thing, so no energy-intensive hot housing is required. They keep well, so although they are often grown thousands of miles away from the end consumer, they're transported by boat, which per kilo of freight transported emits only 1% as much CO2 as planes do. And there is hardly any packaging involved. This is my friend Justin, by the way, formerly from Ontario. He's living in Queensland, Australia now, where he's involved in the regenerative agriculture movement, designing food forests, which means that no farmed animal inputs, grown veganically, which means that no farmed animal inputs are used in the system to maintain soil fertility. Of the hundreds of banana varieties in existence, almost all the ones we get to eat are of the Cavendish variety in the last slide at the top. And the adoption, so it's not true that all bananas are too good to be true. The adoption of the Cavendish as a monoculture crop has been criticized for degrading land and egregious pesticide uses. Fair trade and organic bananas are a better choice for the ecologically conscious. So generally speaking, cargo ships are the most efficient mode of transportation, followed by trains, then trucks, and lastly, planes. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, air freighting takes 50 times the energy of shipping by sea, 33 times that of rail transport, and 4 times that of truck transport. There are exceptions to every rule, of course, because distance traveled and underutilizing the carrying capacity of any one mode of transportation can make a significant difference. I'm not sure if I had those slides in the right sequence there. But anyway, centralized food access today makes the notion of one-stop shopping attractive for the same reason, obviously, right? Less travel time for us as well, especially when we can combine our visit to the local farmer's market with recycling packaging that might otherwise end up in a landfill. Whole foods are almost always going to be preferable to processed foods, but exceptions would include plant-based alternatives to conventional animal products, for example, provided the bulk of those ingredients are sustainably sourced and the overall energy involved not egregious. I miss these people. The very good butchers, who of course started right here at our Saturday market with their vegan organic products, are a great example of young entrepreneurs who have embraced the opportunity to be part of what has today become one of the fastest growing sectors in the food industry. And that is providing more sustainable alternatives to traditional animal products. In a little over 2 short years, the Very Good Butchers have experienced phenomenal growth with the help of the extraordinary Mitchell Scott, I might add, as well as a lot of hardworking Denman Islanders. They've expanded their Victoria storefront to a bigger location than the one pictured here and are looking to build a much larger capacity production facility in Vancouver in the very near future. Now, the fact that demand for these products is rising so rapidly is indicative, of course, of the growing flexitarian movement. Success depends upon appealing to the palates of those who are willing to modify their diets but aren't quite ready to stray too far from the comfort of the old familiar. Since 2016, vegan food brand Beyond Meat has positioned its products, plant-based burgers created to look, feel, taste, and cook like their animal-based counterparts, as healthier and more sustainable. Recently, the company went a step further and commissioned researchers at the University of Michigan Center for Sustainable Systems to put its flagship product, the Beyond Burger, through a life cycle analysis, LCA, through an LCA study, to determine how its environmental impact, greenhouse gas emissions, energy, water, and land use, compares with production of a traditional beef burger. The report was released in September, and it found that Beyond Burger generates 90% fewer greenhouse gas emissions, requires 46% less non-renewable energy, has more than 99% less impact on water scarcity, and 93% less impact on land use than a quarter pound of U.S. beef. Yeah. To give you an idea of the real-life impact, according to a spokesperson for Beyond Meat, and I quote, "On average, Americans eat 3 burgers a week." Yeah. And that's the average, so you can imagine some people are living on them. If they switch just one of these beef burgers to a Beyond Burger for a year, it would be like taking 12 million cars off the road and saving enough energy to power 2.3 million homes. There's no question that many animal-free, so-called vegan-friendly products on the market today may contain ingredients well worth avoiding. It can pay to have a magnifying glass with you when you go shopping just to check the ingredient list. But an obvious one to avoid is palm oil. Palm oil comes from specific palm trees that require tons of water to grow. To clear space for plantations, developers bulldoze rainforests, stripping endangered orangutans, elephants and tigers of their natural habitat, and forcing native people off their lands. And yes, it can seem like it's in damn near everything, especially when it comes to processed foods. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon to find palm oil in vegan cheeses. I think it's important to contact producers and discourage its use. If we aren't prepared to try making certain items at home with more sustainable ingredients, maybe we don't really need them. So when it comes to the eco-footprint of alternatives, like to dairy products, even water-guzzling almonds are a far superior choice. But almonds grown in California require pasteurization, and that involves the super toxic fumigant propylene oxide. If I'm pronouncing that correctly, I don't know. But anyway, farmers are also allowed to use glyphosate. If you want to avoid these known carcinogens, the state law in California will allow a daily purchase of up to 100 pounds of raw unpasteurized almonds directly from the farmer. Otherwise, we're looking at Europe to import unpasteurized organic almonds. The majority of cashews come from India and Vietnam, and picking them is not an easy process. Cashew apples have several tough layers that need to be discarded, and those layers are toxic. Workers earn a pittance for shucking cashews, and many have suffered permanent damage from the toxic liquid that the shells release. In fact, I've seen people with stubs for fingers. Not in person, but, you know, pictures online. An expose by Time magazine uncovered Vietnamese cashews as often the product of forced labor, staffed by people addicted to drugs, and they coined the term blood cashew. So cashews as well really should be avoided altogether unless they are organic and fair trade. This makes them cost prohibitive for most people, unless you are making them or using them in small quantities, which I do actually personally when making my own homemade vegan cheeses. These aren't mine, by the way, but just a reasonable facsimile. I'd set it up like that. You know I would. Brazil nuts, though, these are pretty incredible things. According to the World Wildlife Fund, they've long been prized among Amazonian peoples for their nutritional value. They're high in protein, carbohydrates, and good fats. The trees they grow on are among the tallest trees in the Amazon. And each of these coconut-sized fruits contain up to 24 pods or seeds. These are the nuts. Brazil nut trees produce for hundreds of years, but only when there's a few types of insects around to pollinate them. These insects will only do what they need to do if the trees are growing wild. And since they can't be cultivated, that means the Brazil nut industry helps preserve patches of wild rainforest and supports the farmers that care for the trees. But of course, the surest way to maintain a low carbon footprint when it comes to nuts, whether we use them to make dairy-free milk, cheeses, or enjoy them in more traditional ways, is to grow, purchase, or barter for varieties that will thrive in our own climate zone. Hazelnuts, a great example of sustainable agriculture. Not only do they require little water and minimal upkeep, they can thrive in harsh soils where other plants would fail. They're drought resistant, can survive harsh weather conditions, have a high yield per plant, and help prevent soil erosion. They also have a massive root system, and I didn't know this. They remove a huge amount of carbon from the atmosphere. Walnuts have been grown here on Deman for a very long time, and there are some absolutely incredible trees out there. Oh my God. Somebody down on Swan Road has walnuts that are like, I don't know, gigantic. I just couldn't believe it. Very old tree. And there are also edible chestnuts available in our region. I don't know of any on Denman, but we can certainly support our local tree farmers, or the people growing our trees. In short, there's an abundance of protein-rich nuts accessible to us with a low-carbon footprint. And, of course, the time to plant more trees is always now, yesterday. Well, the acorns in the background there, a bit more difficult to process given their high tannin content, but are one of well over 550 different species of plants that have been documented in the literature as having been utilized in one way or another in the traditional diets of Indigenous peoples of Canada and neighboring areas. This book, one of my favorites, is by renowned BC ethnobotanist and ethnoecologist Nancy Turner. It's a must-read if you'd like to learn more about this particular topic. Unfortunately, you know, our species, not Indigenous people, but, our, you know, I would say the colonizers, in concert with those who have, you know, and with those we've domesticated, the animals that we've brought along, have contributed to a staggering degree of biodiversity loss in an incredibly short period of time. So although there isn't time here tonight to get into exploring all the amazing low-carbon foraging and wall crafting potential in both the forest and marine environments, provided we do a better job of protecting those ecosystems, it must be said that there are simply too many of us on the planet today to return to living off the land collectively as hunter-gatherers in any sustainable way. But that said, there is much to learn from the wisdom of our forebears that will surely guide us forward as we prepare to meet the challenges of a changing global climate. Returning to the question of how food can be grown sustainably without reliance on farmed animal inputs, the wisdom of the ancient indigenous peoples of Mesoamerica is a case in point. For millennia, prior to colonization and the European introduction of non-indigenous species to Mesoamerica, large populations of people thrived on what is called the milpa system. Planted together, the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, are environmentally complementary. At well-managed levels, crops grown in a milpa constitute a nutritionally balanced, self-sustaining food system. Sweet potatoes, melons, other crops can be part of a traditional milpa. No artificial fertilizers, no animal inputs like cow manure, blood, or bone meal required. Today, vegan organic, also known as stock-free farming, is flourishing around the world. I brought a copy of that magazine with me because I thought it might interest people interested in biochar. It's a great article in this particular issue on biochar. The term veganic agriculture or stock-free, these terms broadly mean any system of cultivation that excludes artificial chemicals, livestock manures, animal remains from slaughterhouses, genetically modified materials, and indeed anything of animal origin such as fish meal. And I'm talking, of course, farmed animals. Growing Green International is a quarterly publication, always chock full of information on soil science and agroecology, sharing information between members of the burgeoning vegan organic network, which is centered in the UK from around the world. Vaughan has produced the world's first set of stock-free, animal-free organic standards. And Tollhurst Organics in the UK was the first of its kind to receive stock-free certification. One of the longest-running organic farms in the country, over 40 years, Tollhurst Organics operates a box scheme that supplies over 400 families, and the farm boasts a remarkably low carbon footprint. Says Ian Tollhurst, "We produce and distribute around 120 tons of vegetables every year directly from the farm, utilizing stock-free methods, growing all of our own plants, over 140,000 per annum, ensuring that we are operating as near as possible to a closed system. Calculating all energy use on the farm, the total carbon footprint comes to around 8 tons. Compared with supermarket conventional produce, we are 90% more efficient." So in place of the brown manure used by conventional farmers who raise livestock, veganic farmers rely on cover crops, as Lisa was mentioning. They're a very important part of all organic farming. And these are referred to as green manures. So essentially, cover crops feed the soil directly, rather than being passed through the body of an animal first. Similar to avoiding the opportunity cost of feeding animals plants we could eat directly ourselves, cover crops take the need for livestock out of the equation. And this is how Spuds Co-op has applied stock-free growing techniques for over a decade here on Demmin, operating as a polyculture in ongoing crop rotation with different species of nitrogen-fixing plants in the mix, growing at the same time, always feeding the soil before and after it nourishes us with potatoes. In place of the brown manure used by conventional farmers who raise livestock, and those are our potatoes. I appear to be missing my last and, of course, the most important one. Wouldn't be the case. Yeah. So what I had said here was that, I really wish that there were time to give you some more examples of veganic agriculture around the world. There are just amazing things going on out there. Regenerative agriculture, restoration ecology, literally turning deserts, back into flourishing ecosystems, food forests of all kinds. Sedana Forest in India, Haiti, and Nepal. In Oroville, you know, India, they took over a 10-year period planting trees in dried areas, desertified areas. They managed to raise the water table 12 feet. So women who've been, you know, hiking for miles to get water every day can now go back to their original wells. The flora and the fauna has come back. Folks, there is such hope here. There is so much good work happening. And it's done by leaving out those big carbon emitters. We just don't need them. So in closing, I thought, you know, I want to just say, when I was researching the Milpa system a little bit more, a picture of this baby popped up in my newsfeed on Facebook. And I was really taken by her. She was born on the 31st of October. And here she is. This is Guadalupe. And, you know, she was born, she's a member, her mother was with the migrant caravan. So I don't know who her parents are, but I just can't help but wonder what kind of a life awaits her and what kind of world we'll all be living in by the time she turns 12. All I'm really certain of is that a healthy, safe future for her and for all of our children is well worth striving for. Thanks so much for listening.